It's time for the movie right. Tonight's victim is screenwriter, musician, and director Tom McLaughlin has done Friday 13th, Jason Lives, amongst many other things. Hello.
Hey, how are you guys?
Fantastic, man. So tell us what we have brewing up lately. I know you mentioned you got some big things happening, and well, if you are allowed to talk about it, let's get into it.
Well, in terms of big, I guess that's very up to the listener to decide whether it's big or not. I mean, for me, big would be, yes, the script got sold, and, you know, I'm making the next Friday the 13th, and the lawsuits over and all that. That would be fate to me. But these are things that kind of are all kind of happening, I guess, the last half a year or so. But one of the first ones, obviously, people are listening if they're Friday the 13th fans, is the release of Shout Factory's super duper deluxe, everything you could possibly ever want or think you wanted in a box set of Friday the 13th movies will be coming out in October 13th, I think. That's something that I know I got to add some stuff into that, which I'm very happy about. Besides, they have all the like commentaries I've done over the years for all the different movies, so you can hear three different versions, I think, of that, plus everybody else that they got to do commentaries on it. There was a sort of a documentary, like about a five-minute black and white documentary that was done for a supplemental part of Crystal Lake Memories that was coming out, and it ended up making it onto like a third disc or something, and, you know, really didn't get seen much, and I've had it on YouTube for quite a while, and they decided they wanted to put that on, which is, to me, great, because I think a lot of fans haven't seen that. It's about how I actually wrote Friday the 13th in the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, kind of used whatever vibe I was picking up there, particularly for the opening. Then it also sets up what I'm planning to do in my afterlife with the mausoleum there that I used for One Dark Night. And then we have another interview that they did with me in the mausoleum in front of my crypt, discussing a bunch of different things that we haven't talked about before regarding the movie and horror and things. And then also kind of setting up my game plan is what I've been in preparation for over 10 years now, what I want to do in terms of communicating after I'm gone. And this is something that, you know, some people go, yeah, he's crazy. And then I respond, yep. So I got in the show business. But at the same time, you know, I've done so much research on paranormal and psychic sciences that I really believe there's a method to doing this. And then that's part of, you know, the experiment that I'm going to pull off. But of course, I won't know whether I did or not because I'll be gone. But hopefully anybody that comes to the crypt after I'm gone will have some sort of encounter. And that's a huge thing for me because it's like, you know, after life, the show still goes on. And this is what I'm kind of setting in motion. And then also on the disc, I talk about the script that I wrote, Jason Never Dies. And a lot of fans are, you know, aware of that, but it, you know, takes place in the winter. Jason returns to Crystal Lake. The entire cast is female, not all the same age, but it's basically Jason versus the women folk. It's going to have a lot of unique twists in it. There's going to be some story twists that kind of kick back to my Jason Lives script. I'm setting it in 1999, which was a big year for kind of the fear of a transition happening when it turns to 2000, although that doesn't directly have to do with the movie. But again, it's just that was a very strange year, and certainly not as strange as 2020. There was a lot of fear about what was going to happen with computers and all that. And the big thing is, you know, Jason's going to have a little bit different of a look because he's been down there 13 years. And I really wanted to make it as like a continuation of mine and giving the fans that feeling of the 80s, 90s in terms of the look and the vibe and, you know, the story continuing. You know, the one big thing that for sure is, you know, happening, the band, we've been in absolute standstill. The Sloths were supposed to tour at the beginning of summer and on and off through the summer. We had shows, we had recordings that we were going to do, and even just rehearsing, we can't get together. So everything came to a screeching halt. But I decided I still wanted to do a music video and have it be kind of relevant to the times. So we've just finished putting this together. It's called Want a New Life, and it's a song actually that's from our Back from the Grave album, but visually, it's us performing this song, and you're going to see all the things that have been so horrible about this year. And the lyrics of the song deal with, I want a new life, this isn't what I was promised, I thought this, you know, things were going to go this way and that way. And so it's a big, huge, angry lament to the way the situation is right now. And that'll be released probably within the next few weeks. We were trying to set that up. And then just yesterday, I was shooting this reality series called Cemetery Man. And Cemetery Man is basically me. I'm hosting this show, taking people to all the most incredible cemeteries all over the world and talking basically about how people are remembered, stories about people, weird things that happened at particular cemetery or that particular cemetery, the searching for different rituals and different ways of burial that we lots of times don't know about, cultures that dig up the body and party every year with them and then put them back. I mean, there's so many bizarre things out there. Cemetery Man, which I didn't create, but asked to be the host of, is going to be a very different type of show. Very excited to be a part of that. So that's coming down the pike. God knows when, because we still have these limitations of shooting, holding all of us back. But there's one thing I did forget. This is a big one. I can't believe that I did forget it. And it's big in the context of what's going to also be on the Jason Lives, the script, Jason Never Dies. I'm going to be showing concept drawings. Got this terrific designer, illustrator back in New York who's been working with me on these. So you get kind of a peek in at what I'm planning and kind of basically sort of the look of where I'm going with Jason. You know, most of these are pencil sketches, so there's a lot of details that you're going to miss. But at the same time, it will be a chance to kind of see the way I want this movie to go.
Oh, man. And everyone is always homing in for this movie. And everybody desperately wants this movie out. Everybody desperately wants you to do it. And of course, in my opinion, I think you're the best choice to do it since this is your baby as well. Not just because of that, but because of what you did with Jason Lives. Because I've mentioned this before, this movie, a lot of people are like, oh, what's the big deal about it? Well, the big deal is that, to me, my opinion is, Jason Lives is a movie that has actual character. Not only did you just take an existing character from a previous of the franchise and actually gave him a little bit more story to further on. You can go on a mini pass on how Tommy has become, but we see it from final chapter and we see it all the way through up until this point. The victims themselves have actual character. It's not the stereotype. It's not the jock. It's not the tough guy. It's not this, not that. It's not a repetitive thing. We've already seen it throughout the remaining of the franchise, and that's why I love this one so much. And it's got a really cool heavy metal soundtrack because you got Alice Cooper, dude.
Yeah, Alice's music was such a great thing to be able to have.
There are a lot of filmmakers that dream to do the next Friday the 13th film or Nightmare on Elm Street film. Do you think that influence can actually show a little bit too much on their film and less of the vision they want to show the audience, much like what you've shown on Jason Lives, that you want to show your perspective you envision? But do you think influence is kind of almost a little bit of a no-no that you can't like actually show it on there, so to speak?
Well, yeah, first off, I got to say I was extremely blessed to be able to make the film I wanted to make when I did Jason Lives. I had one simple marching order, bring Jason back from the dead, however you want to do it. And then I wanted to put comedy in it, and so I asked permission, can I go ahead and have there be a sense of humor about this without making fun of Jason or anything, but just still make a Friday film, give the sense of what the whole mythology is about Jason and make the characters aware there was this supposedly character Jason that was out there, so that to them it's not serious. Tommy, obviously, it's very serious. Through the whole movie, it was just great to just have Frank Mancuso Jr. be so supportive. Now, as time has gone on, been, I don't know what, seven Fridays since, six, seven, I kind of lose count. And then, of course, the remake that Michael Bay's company did and things, there's been so much that's happened and so many opinions and so many people that grew up on my movie and the other earlier ones were now in power at production companies and studios and stuff. Everybody's going to have an opinion of the kind of movie they want to see. Yeah, I think for whether it's me or any filmmaker coming in and going, okay, here's my vision, that's it, that's going to be next to impossible. It's certainly not like the Marvel series where you've got 80 people all making that movie and the director just has to kind of wrangle all the different ideas and all the pre-visualization things that they do so that everybody can see what the movie is exactly going to look like before they shoot a frame of it. They're so planned out of it. I don't think it would be that kind of situation, but there's going to be so much anticipation and so much, we got to get this right. We got to get the franchise back after 11 years or whatever. Well, for the fans, it's like, it is back. It's, the fan films and all that have kept this alive. And that's really been the thing to me that's been so amazing. It's like you take away something and it's like, fine, we'll make it. It's just been very cool. And I was involved with Vengeance, which I really had a great time working with PJ Graham on that. And now they're making a Vengeance 2, Bloodline. They're bringing back the cast. I'm coming back for it. There'll be some more encounters between me and Elias Voorhees, though I think even cooler than the first one from what I hear they're planning. But anyway, they have the control because the money is not coming from a big other source. It's, fan-funded. And all they have to do is really make the kind of movie that the fans would love, and they're fans themselves, so there's that kindred spirit. But when you get up to the level where it's millions studio, or in this case, two studios, New Line and Warner Brothers, that are involved with it. It's going to be tough for anybody to make a vision. I'm hoping I have somewhat of a leg up because of my past, but at the same time, it's like they may want to hire the latest hot music video director or somebody that's been, you know, running some great show that everybody loved, Walking Dead, or any show that's been really cool. The competition is immense, and from my standpoint, it's like I needed to write this thing. I really want to make this movie. I really think it pleased the fans so much in terms of the kind of, you know, way I'm going to approach this and some of the kind of twists and things in the storyline. But whether that'll happen or not, once that lawsuit is settled, who wants what at that time? And that's where we all have to kind of wait and see.
Would you say this is the type of franchise, it's best left to be a complete mystery rather than having to explain everything? There's a lot of franchises that like to explain everything, and there's nothing wrong with some explanation, but in my opinion is I like to be in the dark on some of this stuff. I like to play with the idea of what this character is like. Jason Voorhees, there's so many different questions and theories about Jason Voorhees, like all over the groups and everything else, saying about the father and about the character himself. But I think that's great though, because it keeps him talking. But if you were to make a film explaining exactly how it happened, when that kind of ruins the magic of what the lore and what the overall tone of that character and the story is all about.
I can only speak for myself, and what I wrote is not giving really any explanations of anything. And there's no Tommy Jarvis, there's no Jason's father, there's no Jason's mother. It's just he's back and he has another agenda different from what he had in my other one. And in that agenda, there will be kind of a twist that if you have seen My Jason Lives, you'll get exactly what this is. If you haven't, you know, you're just going to see this on a Saturday night, your friends, it still, you know, will work because there will be a flashback that'll kind of tell you that bit of information. But I'm not trying to re-educate anybody in terms of what the legend and mythology is. I felt I did that by Jason Lives. This is just pedal to the metal horror and with a little bit of dark humor, not as much as I had in the other one, but I just kind of look at this as like, you know, the ultimate monster movie where Jason is the monster of the generations that have grown up with him.
Now, horror is an amazing genre, but do you think this is the best place for film artists alone to really have a testing ground of what they're really made of, aside from going to the other genres? Do you think this is the main one that they should really challenge themselves in characterization, or even just to work on story alone?
You know, things have changed so much, and to be honest, nobody knows what the fuck the world is going to be like and what people are going to want when all this COVID shit disappears. People have been in a whole another frame of mind worldwide, and going back to the movies, all these things, concerts, whenever that's going to happen, are we going to get back the same vibe as we had before? I don't think so. Not exactly. I mean, in time, things will go obviously the way they're supposed to go. So in terms of young filmmakers coming up, you could make a horror movie, low budget, and have it deliver. You basically could get your next job because, you know, it would have made money and it was be successful. Now, you know, we get, you know, on the streaming, and so if you're going to put out a movie, either it's got to be so independent and cool that there's just like a select crowd that goes and sees it and was done low budget enough that they can take the risk of releasing it in theaters. If not, it's like goes right to Shudder, which is nothing wrong with Shudder's great, love what they do, and there's going to be other places I think that are going to do it too, but I don't know. The whole horror audience, I think, is going to be very different from what it used to be. You know, Friday nights, I for one would be there at that first show, you know, 8 o'clock with the crowd of, you know, I always call the Yahoo crowd because, you know, they're there to, you know, have a great time for, you know, the new movie. You know, I've got a taste of that when it came out and the sequel, you know, there was some really kind of loyal followers to that. You know, whatever you think of the movie, it still was big studio horror movie. How that's all going to play out in the future, I don't know. You know, nobody knows, which is what the studio is so scared about, you know, where to invest their money.
Since Halloween is just around the corner, horror is such a massive significance, not just in cinema, but also as the history itself, everything and every aspect of it. Do you think that as modern day filmmakers that have made horror films, do you think they've actually changed what the meaning word of horror is? Or do you think that some of that significance may have faded away a little bit, even though we got all this new stuff and all this new marketing and all this other stuff from then to now? Do you think that change has tilted a little bit in the balance, or do you think it's actually enhanced more for horror lovers to really embrace that?
You're starting back all the way to, you know, Dracula and the Universal monsters and stuff. Yeah, it's been a long and a lot of product in the horror genre. And, you know, we now have obviously divisions of, well, this is a slasher movie, or this is like a experimental horror movie, or this is, you know, people going crazy and out in the woods or whatever. They, you know, there's categories for everything, because obviously the success, huge success of Walking Dead, you know, the zombie thing is still, I don't think, completely died out, but I think people are pretty burned out because there's been so many zombies or satire of zombie movies, whatever that's been done. So yeah, I'm always for somebody coming up with something that you go, I haven't seen anything like this before. What that is, anybody's guess. Blair Witch came out, and for everybody, this was something we hadn't seen before. I mean, this film that looked like it really happened, and, you know, there wasn't a bloody, gory thing at all, and, you know, it was just a whole new resurrection of the old, old basics of just out there alone and scared, except you got a video camera, and you only get bits and pieces of it. The characters are running or whatever. Finding another one of those, I'm sure they're out there, and somebody certainly will. And then, in terms of classy, very long horror movie, The Haunting of Hill House, that was on Netflix, to me, really delivered in all the old school way, but of course, it, because it was going to go over whatever it was, 8 episodes or something, you know, they really had to stretch the story out. But I thought they did such an amazing job on it that it really worked. But that also was different, certainly not what the standard 90-minute little horror movie used to be. But what do fans want? I think they just want stuff that delivers. You go in with expectation that you're going to have some sense of scared, horrified, afraid. What a lot of filmmakers don't do is give you characters that you care about and relate to, so when all these things are happening, you're caught up with it. The movie Quiet Place, that to me was one of those ones that you really cared about those people, and you really identified with that situation, and there's a huge want to see for Quiet Place 2, which I hear is also supposed to be incredible, and they don't want to release that movie in any kind of streaming fashion. They want to put it in the theaters for the audience that it's intended for, and I think there's these ones that'll come up like that that'll have such a great impact on people and really deliver a scary thing because you care, and that rule to me is always important to have. When making a sequel, one of the hardest things about sequels are you going to do it just like you did before, so the audience is going to go, yeah, it was great, but it was exactly like the first one was. You wanted it to go someplace else. If you make a choice and make it incredibly different from the first one, people can go in and go, yeah, it didn't have the same stuff that the first one had. So somehow you've got to find the balance of, you know, there's something about it that definitely makes you feel like this is that story moving forward, and things either were set up like that, or in most cases, things that really surprise you because you didn't expect that length of the story. I mean, that's what these franchise films need to do, is each time, you know, you have to come up with something that is going to be unique but not so far off what happened with Halloween 3. John didn't want to do another masked killer piece. He wanted to take it someplace else, and, you know, as a result, you know, the fans were not happy. It didn't have Michael Myers in it, so, you know, it's sometimes, you know, you can't make something too different because you lose the audience that, you know, loves it for the reason of the character. It's so much about if you can get the whole committee that are involved in making the film. And, you know, I thought the new Halloween came out with, you know, Jamie being back again, and I thought that there's some really great stuff, and I was very excited to see it because of the fact that they were going to go back and to the old rules and bring back Michael and this, you know, the way he was supposed to be. But I had this, you know, feeling after I watched it that this wasn't totally the director's vision, that there was a lot of input, a lot of things in there that maybe he wanted, but I got the sense that, no, we got to have this kind of scene, we got to have this, we got to have that. And as a result, sort of that same thing with the sequel to It, there was a lot of people peeing on that tree to mark their own territory and justify a paycheck on payroll at a studio. Not exactly what, you know, the director would have done if he was totally left alone. But when you're dealing with somebody else's money, they do have a say-so, and you have to do what you can to take whatever their creative ideas are and make them work.
Go ahead and plug in anything that you want to continue to share or reshare.
There was something else. Oh, God, I can't believe I forgot about this. There is a new social network that was created called Sue, PSU, and they are also part of putting together a group of filmmakers to do a movie, which will probably end up being a series, but right now it's, you know, kind of looked at as an online movie called Black Veil. One of the directors that's part of it and kind of part of his brainchild is Daniel Merrick, who created Blair Witch Project. Also, Jeffrey Reddick, who did the Final Destination franchise, who was the writer and creator for that, and he's just directed his first movie, and myself, and went to Danny McBride, and just a lot of other directors that are all part of this thing. And it going to be an exciting anthology, and anthologies have always been tough. The different stories and from different directors, but usually for horror fans, it's like, you know, there's always, you know, cool stuff in those things. When it works, it's great because it's short, dynamic, and not having to deal with a lot of the structural things that a feature has to do. We, you know, we were all ready to get totally going on that, and Dan shot his one, but the rest of them, you know, we have to wait for the fucking pandemic to be over before we can do it. And it's going to be cool in that it's also Southern Gothic. You know, everybody's going for that vibe and shooting it down in Florida. And in the meantime, they came up with this idea that we're all kind of a part of called Quarantine Creep Fest. And it's a chance for filmmakers, whoever you are, wherever you are, to make a short film that really you can only make because you're in quarantine. You know, you're dealing with those elements and those restrictions and things. You come up with this creative and scary of a premise that you can, and these films will be sent to us, and we will look at them and pick a few of them that will be the winners. And there's a big camera package that goes to the first place winner, and I think $1,000 or something, and money to the second place and third place. You know, it's a way for us to stay involved and we'll wait for the movie to happen, and give other young filmmakers, don't have to be young, be any age, you know, make something and have it be seen by all of us who really are genre people. You know, that's going on right now as well.
There you have it, everybody. That is screenwriter, musician, and director Tom McLaughlin.